welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program. I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times. This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time. Hello, I'm Rob Greaves, and thank you for joining me once again for another program in the Listen to Older Voices series. This week, part two, the final part of my talk with Don Carlos. If you missed part one, allow me to recap. Born in 1936, Don grew up in Prahran, Victoria. His father was a socialist member of the then Australian Engineers Union, which indelibly left a mark on Don's political development. Having had a real outdoors adventurous lifestyle, where activity and adventure came before study, Don eventually joined the insurance industry, where he would leave and return frequently. From my point of view, it's his story of his relationship with Australian jazz musician Frank Traynor and the development of one of Melbourne's first folk clubs in Exhibition Street, Melbourne, that's the most fascinating. This week, we learn more about the club and its machinations. There are more stories of Don's insurance experiences. We learn about his involvement in one of Melbourne's embryonic communes in Erika, Victoria, and learn about his marriage in Hong Kong to Gail. First, we pick up with Don talking about Frank Traynor.
Nice guy, but if you knew him, well, it'd drive you bloody mad, you know. But you know, he used to storm in with these great ideas and we'd say, terrific, Frank. He said, well, if you don't do it, you can buzz off. And we'd say, Frank, here's £2 or $2 or whatever it was. I'm going down to buy a little tin of paint and a paintbrush, because that's all it'll cost to take your name off the top of this building, you know. Oh, you bastards. And he'd storm off to the pub or go and rest in the arms of Glenn or whoever his current mistress was. There, they were funny years, yeah. And we had to round up all the folk singers we could find. Brian Mooney and Martin Wyndham Reid, John Graham.
Gee, you really were there at the beginning of the scene.
Oh, yeah. Well, there weren't any. Danny Spooner and his mate had just come in from the UK, and Gordon McIntyre. You're looking for singers. He said, we haven't got any money. He said, that's all right. We've been singing, you know, these sea shanties and whatever. Oh, I think, And I think Danny launched into his career as a tugboat captain at that stage, you know. It's all frog shit, you know. As far as I knew it was, anyway. You know. But they'd work for a share of the door, which was a couple of quid and same as me. Right. Attractive ladies, and it wasn't a bad place, and things were happening there, and they got their photo in the paper now and again, and all that. Yeah. So it was a pretty happy outfit, really. I think they might have whinged about, there's a terrible lot of, I don't think it ever occurred to me how many partners there were, you know, who's whacking up this money, you know. And as Jimmy and I said, well, you know, in our previous experience, that who counts the money first is the most important place,
right,
you know, in the organisation. So he and I'd be up there bloody counting all this in front of Frank, and Frank would be saying, can I have some? So we'd give him some.
They sound like they were very enjoyable years for all the little trolls.
Oh, young man, yeah, I was full of bloody go and piss and vinegar. And, you know, once a fortnight I'd have a fight with a customer, and it's right up my alley, you know. Jimmy was a drummer by profession, and he worked for, worked with Tex Morton and Assorted Circuses, Ashton family and all that. So he had a different alley to me. I had nothing better to do than run the coffee lounge. And then there was, and Frank and his bit. And yeah, so we were pretty active. It wasn't as if anybody was trying to rely on all this, because every now and again I'd go back to the insurance.
Oh, right.
And I can make good money there.
Right.
When I was youngish, I don't know, I was probably 21 or something, the claims manager for the group picked me out and said, you should be in claims. And F.J. Darcy, wonderful man, and he taught me everything that he could do as far as investigating insurance claims. And I worked, it was the first time in my life I found something I wanted to do, and I worked bloody hard. And he was Fabo, you know. He introduced me to insurance lawyers, solicitors, Henry von Bibra, who's, God bless him, as far as I know, Henry's still alive. And myself and another boy would go down to, who was, I think was Frank's son, I think. We'd go down to Henry's office at night after work, and he'd give us an hour's lecture on what we were looking for in claims. And it was a very good foundation.
What did you do then? What did you do in terms of claims investigation?
Talk with the people who were making the claim and make an assessment about whether you liked it or not. Or
right. Most claims genuine, did you find?
As far as we could tell, yeah, yeah. In the early days, anyway, you know, they were, you know, in the 70s. And yeah, they were, yeah. And then people got smarter, they were better educated. And I was dealing with their parents, you know, who were very much working class people. And, you know,
yes.
I'd be telling them, look, you can put that into the claim, you know. It might only be a wedding ring that you paid $40 for, but...
So you were actually helpful in terms of...
Oh, I thought so, you know, yeah. And there'd be plenty I'd say, look, that bloody fence has fallen down on its own, it's got nothing to do with it.
Yes.
So there was coming and going. I could live with myself in the sort of job that I was doing, you know. And I wasn't trying to rip off the company or the clients for that matter, you know.
Right.
Yeah, but it was a skill which I recognise as a skill, and realised that I could live on this for years, you know. I didn't know for years, but where my contemporaries were going off and being hired away from the company by other insurance companies, like typical business, they weren't training people to. They were using their labour, and when it suited them, they'd piss them all off, you know. Well, they ran out of people to run their companies in the end. The boys had come back from the war, they were retiring or burnt out, and they had no one to take over. You know, they hadn't taught anyone, you know. The commercial union did have this scheme of teaching people, and as I found out years later, I didn't have to have a reference. If I said I'd been at the commercial union for 10 years,
oh,
got the job straight away, I was a valuable commodity. I didn't realise that, but it was a long time after it that I found out that people, okay, you got 90% ticked straight away, you know.
Well, tell me, Don, how does a man who has up to this point spent a lot of his life working insurance, and when he's not working insurance, he's pretty heavily involved in the folk music scene in Melbourne, how did you come to get involved in Asia?
I think it was about 66. I wanted to have a holiday. I had the money, went to Singapore. Loved it. From then on, I was always going back there, and then I figured out a way to make a living there.
How was that?
It was horses, you know, race horses.
Okay.
They were mad for bloody race horses. They still are in Hong Kong, for instance.
Yes.
Well, they were in Hong Kong, Singapore, in Singapore, Malaysia, all that. And the Malaysians had stopped shooting at each other. Yeah, there was a space there for me. Rather not go into all that, really.
Okay.
Because in the end, I had to get out. A few years later, you know, I kept on going back. I'd come back and work in insurance for a while, or with jazz bands or whatever. The folk music, the Bushwhackers. In 1980, I left him. And I never really worked since, you know, other than insurance for a bit.
What is it that you like about Asia? What is it that appeals to you?
Oh, people, the smells. People? I remember all that. Yeah, I remember that very well. The smells particularly I found very interesting. And the lifestyle was just magical. You know, I only had a few dollars. If you only had a few dollars, you could live as well as anybody there. I thought you could, you know. And I'd had a few contacts and I exploited those. And I thought it was really interesting. You know, I read books for days. And there I was in Malacca, where all the pirates came from.
Oh, right.
And whatever, you know, it was...
It still sounds like part of this young man's adventure going on.
Oh, it is. Yeah, great weakness, really, for me, because I couldn't settle down to anything. I never made a career in there, you know. I did adventurous things and horse races and, oh, that sort of thing, you know. Yeah, yeah. A lot of money in one way and another at different times, you know, in which I bought a house here and, you know, in Bratton, which my mother lived in for many years, you know, and I'd live in occasionally when I was back here, you know. In between all that, it's all that crap from Melbourne University and the different Melbourne, Monash, whatever, you know.
Now, hang on, woo, let's tell us about this. we're talking about here in the late 60s, early 70s, aren't we?
Yeah, yeah.
So we're talking about all the political machinations that are going on.
Yes,
because at heart, you're still a political creature, aren't you? You were brought up in this socialist, communist household. So, okay, we're talking about the Albert Langer days here?
Yes, Albert was there, yeah.
Okay, can you share some stories? How you became involved and...
I was driven by all sorts of different things, including ladies with large breasts, you know.
Okay.
And, well, there was nothing better than going to a bloody demo meeting, whatever, you know. And there they were. Marvellous, you know. And aside from that, I wanted to be part of the struggle, I suppose, as long as I could leave when I wanted to, you know.
Right.
And there was a pretty strong socialist attitude of trainers. So all that suited me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We went very far from Tattersall's Hotel on the corner of Russell Street and Little Lonsdale, where all the student art students and artists used to drink. They were heady days. And just how I... what happened there with all that was I used to get away when I felt the need, go and take the car up and camp out in the bush. And one of the girls... She fell in love with a guy, and he was had a master's in what's with plants,
botany.
Botany,
right?
That's right. And I thought he was a bloody whiz kid. He passed every known exam. He had bloody letters after his name forever. He was about 28, and there were only two jobs in Australia he could possibly get with these qualifications. And both had been given to somebody else. It was hopeless. He eventually did start to get some money because the government started, you know, to post Whitlam. Yes, he started to get these. He had to do surveys to get somebody to, before company could start a project. Neville had to go along and say what was going to happen to all the life, the wildlife, and you know, butterflies and all this. So that's, Neville actually got commissions. Technically, he wasn't employed by the companies. And I think he gave a fair reference to it. You know, it was through that girlfriend I decided I'd get out of them. Jimmy had gone to London briefly. Frank was out of control, and he introduced me to his lady who became his wife, and she was happy enough to run the place as long as I could count the money.
Mm-hmm.
And which led, of course, to thinking she was convinced there was all money in this place and was getting, but... The bloody place was running down. Frank had the personality of a rattlesnake, and he'd import 500 bloody guitars from Japan or something, China, you know, sell 8 of them, and the rest of them would sit in the office there forever. Well, you didn't have to be a bloody Rhodes Scholar to work out that this is where the money was going.
Yeah.
You know? So, anyway, I couldn't be bothered with all that, so I gave it away, you know. And Jimmy got back from London and said, what have you done? And I said, well, I'm told him to get, you know. And he said, oh, I'll give it away myself, you know. I think a few months later he quit as well. There was no money in it then, you know. And our singers were going overseas or going to Sydney, or the hardcore of them, you know. The Margaret Smiths got married, went to Little Wangaratta or somewhere. Selfish person. Margaret Rowe Knight had fallen in love with somebody, and
it was all falling apart.
Yeah. So it was running down. It's time to go.
Yeah.
Places in show business don't have great longevity as a rule, unless of very special circumstances. And we got 10 years out of it or something. I forget how long. I couldn't tell you how long it was actually.
Well, Don, you mentioned that at this point, all your good singers were either going overseas or going on to bigger and better things. I've got a piece of music coming up now which will take us back to those heady days, and it features Judith Durham, and we know Judith certainly went on to bigger and better things, and she was singing with Frank Traynor's Jazz Preachers. So let's check out what the music was like from that period.
Did you ever wake up your good man on your mind? Did you ever wake up your good man on your mind? My daddy left me this morning. That's why I'm mourning inside. He'll make you laugh. He'll make you cry. Cry those blues away. You'll sit right down. You'll weep and mourn, and then you'll finally say, Lord, I've been wondering where my daddy been has gone. I can see
you've tuned into Listen to Older Voices, featuring the life and times of older Australians.
Anyway, this lady went to live with the Professor Gumnut at a commune in the hills there, and she said, look, come up. You know, I was in a terrible state, you know, really. I was almost had a mental breakdown. You know, juggling jobs and etc. And so I went up there, and it was bloody marvellous, like I'd never been anywhere else. You know, there were gum trees, and they were nice people. They really were. You know, and that's how I came to meet all that crowd from Bingdon Street, and they're all connected in one way or another, and they were not in any way other than the odd customer that come into trainers, you know. They weren't in any way associated with the folk music or the jazz scene or Asia.
So this was like a new vista.
In
fact, this was the part of the beginning of that alternate scene that grew in Melbourne.
Oh, very much. Yes. People used to come and visit us up there to see how were we running it, you know. People had come from northern New South Wales. Or
For people listening, we're talking about the area around Erica.
So they bought this old timber mill, which had four or five houses on it. Most of all the machinery had been taken away by the guy who sold the ground to them. There's quite a few acres, I don't know, about 80 acres or something. Mm. No electricity, no running water. Yeah. And it had been, they'd cleared all the anything that grew, they cleared in the impression that he was the guy. thought he was helping us out and spent a day, you know, driving. Yeah. For timber, he couldn't use it in the mill, then he'd just flatten the whole bloody way. But anyway, we managed to live through all that. And I was only there on weekends. I'm still getting money from the insurance, you know.
Yes.
And so every couple of weeks I'd turn up there with bottles of gin, and they'd all be living on bloody beans and peanut butter. And I used to go to the supermarket and buy what I imagined, you know, the condescending swine that I was. You know, I'd buy them Wheaties and what I considered to be real food, you know, and real milk and all that. Mm. They were pretty grateful. I made some good friends there.
Yes.
They all came from that University of Melbourne Labour Club.
Sort of went through that whole political thing, and it sounds like became disillusioned with the politics and looked for something in a more alternate lifestyle. Would that be right or not?
Yeah, well, they put up with me. I suppose I played a role in there. They were all, like lots of people who go to universities, they join various clubs.
Yeah.
And they were happy to go along with it. But they were all the ones up there, all the ones I met anyway, were either doctors or botanists. Yeah, they were all very young. And when Whitlam got into power, it was just before my very eyes, not realising it's happening, but they've all gone off to be assistants to the newly elected elite in Canberra.
Right.
Because they were the educated elite who could join the political elite. So there was really only, you know, a couple of us left there, you know. Not that I was only there every second or third weekend or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So that too.
That experiment
had a turnover. But it had a place in, certainly still had a place in my life.
Yes.
And I loved it. I loved the area and all that. And given a choice and some money in my pocket from working, I looked around for a place that had power, so I could play records and listen to my music and while sitting on the veranda drinking gin. And that was when that place came up for sale. And, didn't come up. I wrote to the old lady who owned it, you know. It was practically derelict. The local fire brigade were just about to do an exercise there, burn the bloody place down as an exercise for the local fire brigade, the country fire brigade. And I just got in time. And they were dirty on me for a while. I didn't realise they were dirty, you know, because bloody country towns, you know, and they're all half inbred and, yeah.
And you took their house that they're going to burn down. Yeah, you took it away from them.
And what's more, we had little working bees there and
fixed it up and
and we did, and I hardly spent any money on it, you know, but at least we had tank water and electricity. And
so what did life hold for you from that mid 70 period onward? Because up to then it sounds like it was fairly much go. I mean, just to recap, overseas, you've got music, you've got all sorts of things going. What happened from that point in your life? Did it slow down at all?
No, not really, no. I didn't get up to Erica as often as I liked. Mm-hmm. I would have liked, but I was still there, you know, while I was in Australia, you know. But I was busy falling in and out of love and so forth.
Did you ever get married?
No, not till comparatively recent years.
Right.
1st of April 1985 in Hong Kong, I married a girl I'd worked with in insurance. And
her name was?
Gail.
Gail?
Yes, blind girl.
Right.
And we divorced a couple of years ago now, you know, but by then I was a drunk and a gambler, and I wasn't much of a husband, really. I mean, I had all that background that you've heard about there today. This really did train me for the responsibilities of being married to anyone. You know.
Right.
I'd still be marching on May Day, and you know, if I was in Melbourne, you know,
right,
and that sort of thing. I never displayed any political interest when I was in Asia, but then they took a different view of it. You know, they wouldn't just nod and say, "Music fellow, let's chuck in jail." You know, no, I didn't want to know about that. I was doing things which I ought to be in jail for. Without, I didn't need any encouragement.
But you were still obviously travelling to Asia even into the 80s then.
Oh, yes.
So you've really had a number of years connection with Asia. It's obviously been a very major part of your life then.
Yeah. I could have adventures there.
Yes.
You know, I could have probably had them there if I'd worked at it, but, oh, it's a little boring.
Asia's finished now for you?
Only because of ill health, really. Yes. I'd still be doing it. I'd be there tomorrow, you know.
Yes.
Thinking about it last night. I have to pull myself back and say, you're kidding, you know, you'd go up there, I'd die, you know. I would not get the medical treatment I get here, you know. And I don't have any money left. All that went to God. So I'm at the Alfred Hospital and they're terrific to me, you know? Yeah. But I'm there with 300 or 400 in that patients, you know? And they're not finding a cure for gastro problems and urinary tract problems, and it's all to do with the sort of lifestyle I had. I think it just caught up with me, you know. And about 5 years ago I started this downhill thing in the health, and it's only a couple of years ago that I realised this is all accumulative, you know. I did all those things and I had everything in sight and meals which I should have got to mine poisoning from or whatever, you know, cholera. Never had a moment's problem with it, you know. And I get home and eat a sandwich and I'm crook or something. Ridiculous.
That's unfortunately the ridiculous way life often presents itself, isn't it? Well, Don, look, I mean, you've had your ups and you've had your downs.
Hmm.
But nobody could ever say you didn't go out there and try and grab life.
You know, people went out and had to get on the moon, and I'm standing on the roof of the Musicians Club in Melbourne staring at the Sputniks going by, you know. And I'm with the crowd of musicians and we've all got a drink in our hand and bloody marvellous, you know. I had a great time, you know, yeah.
I think that's a great place for us to finish off. Thank you, Don.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.